Hi, this is Dan Ryback, head of the Family Office Solutions Group. Today's session is with Ambassador Mark Gilbert and Congressman Jeb Hensarling, Vice Chairman within UBS Wealth Management Americas. Mark and Jeb each have incredible depth and expertise in U.S. politics. Mark served in the U.S. Department of State from 2014 to 2017 as U.S. Ambassador to New Zealand. Jeb most recently served as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from Texas's 5th Congressional District from 2003 to 2019, and Chairman of the U.S. House of Representatives Financial Services Committee from 2013 to 2019. Gentlemen, let's center today's discussion on a few hot topics in U.S. politics. Ambassador, let's start off with you. The CARES Act unleashed trillions of dollars in relief funding to corporates and individuals across the country. Help us understand, what did that funding do well, and where is the room for improvement?
Thank you, Anne, and thank you for having us today. I think the legislation, and I'm sure Congress agrees, was the fastest way to get money into the system, to save jobs, to allow families to be able to, you know, to feed themselves, to keep their homes, and also to assist state and local governments with the added expenses that they were having from dealing with COVID. And I believe that it literally saved the economy from falling off the cliff. Yet we still have an additional 13 million people that are unemployed. And what concerns me today is that what happens when the PPP runs out? And you probably saw American Airlines announce last week that starting October 1st, they're laying off 19,000 additional employees. You're seeing a number of major companies doing the same thing. And that's the part that concerns me right now.
Congressman, a follow-up for you. In terms of ongoing coronavirus stimulus proposals, what should we, the public, expect in the coming months and quarters? And how do you ultimately see this playing out?
Well, one, to give it a little context, we are now looking at our nation's single largest fiscal and monetary response to a crisis, again, in our nation's history. And so Congress has a tendency to operate either quickly or not at all. Fortunately, they acted quickly at the beginning of the pandemic. I would say, though, with the passage of time, each piece of legislation has become both more deliberative, more difficult. It's always challenging to write law, and particularly in an election year. So where we stand now is that the two parties seemingly are at loggerheads. They've broken off negotiations. Having said that, having negotiated a number of agreements during my congressional tenure, many of them have a tendency to break off before the final deal is concluded. So Democrats have put a bill on the table. Republicans have put a bill on the table. The major stumbling blocks are the Democrats want a very large number, trillion dollars, in order to backfill kind of state and local government demands. Republicans are less enthusiastic about this. I think both parties would like to see another round of checks to individuals. Both parties have been supportive of the PPP that the ambassador mentioned. And Republicans, I know, really want to kind of fine tune and refine that. And then Republicans are very interested in kind of a liability protection portion of COVID response that the Democrats are not really interested in. So my guess is this gets done in September, probably rolled in to the end of the annual appropriations bills in Congress. Frankly, a lot gets rolled into those bills. Democrats still, again, have a lot of pressure to produce for their blue state governors and senators. Clearly, the president has a huge incentive facing reelection to ensure the economy doesn't slip further. So there's no guarantee, but I think we could see perhaps something close to $1 trillion or a little less with the parties negotiating these two big differences.
And Ambassador, any additional thoughts you may have?
Well, First of all, I agree with the congressman, and of course, he understands how Congress works better than I do. But I do agree that we will get something passed later in the year. I think that will help soften what we're seeing with all the announced layoffs. And I think that both parties are fearful that you have a second dip in the economy and that they'll try to do whatever they can to prevent that from happening.
Thank you both on that. Congressman, let's discuss the balance of power in the U.S. as the current environment has pushed that balance of decision-making authority at the state and federal level to a forefront topic for many. And for those of us that don't quite recall the principles of federalism from our high school history lessons, can you please demystify for us how that works?
Well, I can tell you this much. It doesn't work like the founding fathers thought it might work. So as part of the Bill of Rights, you have the 10th Amendment that essentially says the federal government's powers are to be limited and enumerated, and the powers of the states are to be vast and reserved. One of the reasons it's called the United States of America as opposed to simply United America. But fairly early on in the Republic, the 10th Amendment was viewed to hamper certain kind of necessary functions of the federal government. So you started seeing some erosion there. And then beginning with the New Deal, I would say for a period of well over a half a century, the 10th Amendment was frankly largely ignored. You are now seeing, beginning with the Rehnquist Court, some kind of rollback of federal powers vis-a-vis the states, but kind of the check and balance that founding fathers envisioned is not really where it was at the beginning of the Republic. You combine that with the Interstate Commerce Clause that has also had a rather broad and expansive interpretation, increasingly allowing the federal government to regulate activities that were previously kind of the exclusive purview of the state. And this is particularly true in the healthcare arena, which is why you have seen so much federal activity. And so when you also ask about balance of power, it's not just the aspect of federalism, kind of the power between the federal and the states, the federal government and the state governments. But a balance of power question also has to do with whether or not we still have three co-equal branches in the federal government. And I would say increasingly we do not. And I think it's something that citizens will want to pay attention to. Both parties, frankly, for several decades in Congress, have yielded more and more legislative power to the executive branch. Why? Because the executive branch is far more efficient. And so they become Congress less jealous of their powers in favor of looking for a more efficient way for policy outcomes. And because of that, for example, notwithstanding the fact that our 10th Amendment says that Congress has the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations, you know, we have our president who is, you know, unilaterally applied tariffs. Maybe a good policy, maybe a bad policy, but it's not a policy that has been rendered by Congress. And there's just one more example. It's not just the elected branch of the executive government. For example, it wasn't all that long ago that the Federal Communications Commission voted for something called net neutrality that essentially regulated the internet as a public utility. Maybe good policy, maybe bad policy, but it was enacted by those who were not elected by the people. And so that's another balance of power, I would say, that within the federal government that citizens ought to pay close attention to.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Ambassador, now over to you. So we take this balance of power, dialogue, discussion, perspective, and what should we be watching for in the coming quarters, both in advance of the election and then post-election, right? Are there specific state and federal decisions or proposals that could have meaningful consequences in impacting either the election or managing through the pandemic?
So I think some of the reaction by the states and the performance of their governors will have an effect on the election, where if it's perceived by a certain state that their governor has performed poorly and that governor is the same party of one of the candidates, someone may vote for the other party because of that. Although I don't think it's going to have a significant in someone's decision-making process, it could play a role. But when I look at the states and the local municipalities, my biggest concern for them is that their budgets for next year are going to be a real challenge. Not like the federal government, they don't have the ability to plan for a deficit. So they're going to need federal assistance to be able to do what they or get the help from the federal government to combat the shortfalls that they will have because of the virus. They will not have the ability to raise taxes or fees because the economy is too fragile. And one of the other things that we are seeing happening is you're seeing many wealthy people, companies are fleeing cities and moving to places where they see more open spaces or a place where they think they could have a better life in a post-COVID world. In my opinion, until we get COVID under control, I don't think we're going to get a rebound in the economy. And although individual states have put in certain restrictions, because we're, you know, a country that you can travel freely all around, there's no way to stop the spread until I believe we have something that is nationwide, such as a nationwide mask order or nationwide testing that will allow us to be able to get the coronavirus under control.
Congressman, any additional thoughts on your end?
Well, when you talk about federal and state decisions that may have consequences for the election, I think it is very much in Vice President Biden's interest to make the election a referendum on President Trump. So to a great extent, I believe that President Trump's election prospects are clearly tied to the COVID curve. But I would also say, with roughly whatever the math is, 65, 66 days left until the election, there's a limited number of measures that the federal government can take at this juncture that's going to impact that particular curve. On the other side, the president, so, you know, Vice President Biden wants to tie a poor response that he argues that the administration has. Well, the president and his campaign wishes to argue that, you know, the violence or riots you see in the street contrasted with the peaceful, legitimate protest are rising in blue states with blue state mayors and wants to tie that to Vice President Biden. So decisions that are made by states to allow peaceful protest, to curtail the violence could have an impact on the election. And then as important as reality is, perception is important too. So even if we don't have a COVID vaccine, you know, to the extent the administration gives the people hope that it's just around the corner, that can have an impact on the election as well.
Thank you. It's been a, you know, interesting month of August, right, with the party conventions and lots of, you know, fanfare and, you know, some good conversation that's being sparked. Now that those party conventions have wrapped up, you know, can you articulate sort of three things or a few top things that each candidate has to do to win in November? So, Ambassador, let's start with you.
Okay. I think if we had to boil it down to three, if you look at the Biden campaign, and I think it might be easier for me to look at the Biden campaign and for the congressman to look at the Trump campaign. I think the Biden campaign will make it about competency in government. And, you know, that is all about COVID. I think that will be the number one issue between now and Election Day. I think having a plan to deal with COVID, I think, will also be important. Personally, you know, I do not believe that until we have a vaccine or a treatment or get COVID under control, we're not going to see a rebound in the economy. So I believe having a sound plan to deal with it will be important. And something that I don't think we've seen for many decades in our country, but with everything that's happening in the streets today, I think social justice issues will be very important. And although everybody, you know, talks about pocketbook issues and national security issues, there are a lot of people who don't normally vote, who I believe may vote either for the first time in a long time because they believe that now is the time to deal with these issues. So I think that if I were advising the Biden campaign, I think those are the three places that I would focus.
Thanks for that. Congressman, your thoughts.
Well, I alluded to it in an earlier answer, but what President Trump needs is the reverse of what Vice President Biden needs. And the president needs a choice election and not a referendum election. If this is about personality, the president probably loses. If this is about policy, then the president has a very much a fighting chance to win re-election. So you saw it outlined in the president's acceptance speech last night. And so he's going to do everything he can to try to tie Vice President Biden to the most progressive elements of the Democrat Party on policy and try to tie him to kind of the Senator Sanders, Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez wing of the party. So he clearly needs to do that to make it a choice election. And then second of all, it favors Vice President Biden when the focus is on health care and in COVID. It favors the president when he can focus on the economy. If there's one area that the body politic still gives the president great credit for, it's in the economic arena. So he has to convince the American people he was largely responsible for, you know, the greatest economy in a generation, and he's the one who can do it again. And it may not be three elements, but the last thing I would add is the president is largely running a base campaign. So he has to turn out a larger percentage, which in his case, of a diminishing demographic. And I think he still cannot yield the suburbs where the handful of swing voters and independents still reside. He still has to compete there, and he's got to convince those people that it's not so much social justice protests they're seeing in the streets, but they're seeing violence. There's not calls for police reform. What they're actually seeing are calls to defund the police, and it's not about taking down statues of Robert E. Lee. It's taking down statues of George Washington. So both candidates will kind of try to convince swing voters of what's kind of happening in this arena. And clearly, President Trump has to make the case that it's the latter, not the former.
Really, really fascinating insights from the pair of you. Thank you for that. And I have to ask perhaps one last question here. There's been a lot of discourse around the typical moving away from, you know, understanding the winner of a presidential election the night of, right, voting day. What should the American people expect the presidential election to be called? I mean, I know it's a challenge to perhaps answer this, but, you know, what are your thoughts on that topic? Congressman, I'll turn it over to you first.
Well, I don't necessarily see a scenario with hanging chads, but with mass mail-in voting, I could really see a messy situation, because there are some states who've done it for years and they've perfected their systems, their infrastructure, personnel. Because of COVID, a number of other states are kind of rushing into a process, maybe by necessity, that they are somewhat unequipped for. And so I could see this getting tied up for days, potentially weeks, getting messy in the courts. I hope for the sake of the nation it doesn't come down to that, but it's not an improbable scenario. And then as a side, the control of the Senate, because of an anomaly with a special race in Georgia, we may not know which party controls the Senate until January. So, you know, hold on to your hat and buckle your seatbelt.
Ambassador, any additional thoughts there?
Well, first of all, as always, I agree with the congressman and everything he said about the election and how we hope that we have a result that happens very quickly. There are a lot of states that have done vote by mail or absentee balloting or early voting for a very long time. And as long as that process goes smoothly, I think we're not going to be waiting as long as most people think to get a result.
Ambassador Gilbert, Congressman Hensarling, thank you so much for your time today. Really insightful comments, and I think the entire country will be on the edge of their seats to see what unfolds in the coming months to come. So thank you again for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ann.
UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that clients understand the ways in which we conduct business, that they carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide to them about the products or services we offer. A small number of our financial advisors are not permitted to offer advisory services to you and can only work with you directly as a UBS broker-dealer representative. Your financial advisor will let you know if this is the case, and if you desire advisory services, we'll be happy to refer you to another financial advisor who can help you. Our agreements and disclosures will inform you about whether we and our financial advisors are acting in our capacity as an investment advisor or broker-dealer. For more information, please review the PDF document at ubs.com/workingwithus.